So before I start, I just want to acknowledge the significant contributions of the gentleman you just heard from, Jim Chauvin, whose day job is to actually really lead the policy work. And as volunteers, we would be nothing without the stellar support and leadership from staff like Jim. So what I'm going to do is just spend a few minutes talking a little bit about policy theory. I think it's really important to ground the work that we do in policy theory. I'm not going to do a complete tour of the literature, but what I thought I would do is just talk a little bit about different conceptions of policy and their relationship with advocacy, and then I'll focus in on the role of the Canadian Public Health Association and highlight a couple of case examples of how we've tried to advance evidence-based policy and advocacy, and then talk about some of the areas where we're putting more emphasis, in particular in the area of health equity. And then I'll close off with just some summary remarks about where we think we need to go here. And one of the questions we were asked to also address was, how do we know we've made a difference in our policy efforts? We continually do, but what are some of the metrics that we need to be looking at to advance our policy efforts and really retrospectively also look and prospectively look at whether we've made a difference? So I have no relationships to disclose, and I'm not going to go into other relationships at the moment. The only good news that I got this morning was that my cat was found after 3 days of being missing, so there we go. So I've already covered this a bit, and then the only thing I would add is that the example that I will focus on is asbestos, because I think it's a really interesting one given Canada's history. Generally, Canada has a better reputation maybe on average, except in some areas I think this is a great example of where we are in a major conflict, and so I think that really challenged our policy efforts. So these are just some of the conceptions of policy. I think the key words here are that policy has needs to be conceptualized, I would argue, in a broad way. Often it gets narrowly interpreted as just laws and regulations, but it is also a set of formal and informal rules, because the informal part really speaks to things that are emerging in practice, and we need to get a handle on that. I think in public health, I'd be remiss if I didn't focus on healthy public policies as being really central to the kind of work we do. I think that has major implications because, by definition, healthy public policies is about advancing health, but within not just the scope of health, but very much so about influencing levers outside of health. And so that, I think, begs the question, what are the different conceptions of policy at work in different sectors in addition to what is happening in health? When we talk about policy as an intervention, we're often talking about more than one, because to be effective, we're talking about multi-level policy interventions, and rarely are they implemented by one actor. And I'll come back to this point, because I think an understanding of network and actor theory about how policies get enacted and then play out and the kinds of conflictual relationships between actors in trying to get a hold of policy is important. And so I think that speaks to the last point, which is really that it's a dynamic, iterative, and complex set of processes. So the second point I want to make has to do with the structures that are involved in policy. And again, this is just a short list here, but I think typically in the history of policy research and some of the evidence base that was generated very much from this country and others, it was often associated with those who govern, so the nation, the state, bureaucracies that support nation states. And often sort of really providing a very narrow view of who holds the power, and so policy as an instrument of power. And while I think that certainly holds true in some contexts, that really reflects a very, very sort of outdated view of how really policy plays out, and that these structures are one of several actors that have a role to play in policy. I think the other role that policy has played, and this is something that is very much linked to the literature on welfare state development that Espeen Anderson and others have really advanced, is this role of protective role in decommodification. So what that means is that people are not commodities, but they are really individuals that need to be protected and whose health need to be promoted, since health is a right. And I think policy has an important norm-setting function, and that is also something that we need to keep into account. But some of the critiques, and I've already started to allude to this, is that that this is equated just with the nation state, that therefore that's the focal point, and that has implications for associations like ours who are trying to advocate. And while we may direct many of our advocacy and policy efforts towards the state or levels of government, the indirect ways in which we need to do that may not only directly involve influencing the state. So I think a key word in our statement about public health is that we can't forget the public, and that engaging the public in policy making is really critical. I think another critique is that that agency over there doesn't necessarily account for lived experiences, and I think that has to do a lot with the kind of evidence that tends to influence decision makers, and that tends to be quantitative evidence. And I would argue that qualitative research evidence doesn't often get sufficient traction, but I would say that both are really necessary in terms of bringing that role of human agency and its key role in policy. So just a few words about policy models, and I think I've talked about that. So the origins are very much a normative science, and what I mean by it's been characterized by instrumental rationality is that it's rational, we set out some objectives, we plan to do this, but rarely is policy delivered as intended. And I'll come back into critiques is that often we're ascribing intentionality to policy development where it doesn't necessarily exist. And so that has implications, again, for advocacy. And I think it also speaks to the fact that you put a policy out there and it will take on multiple interpretations. And that is something, again, that I think challenges us in the advocacy effort. This is what I'm trying to keep coming back to. And then thirdly, I allude to this already, but I think in thinking about policy, taking an actor-oriented perspective is really important. And so current thinking really suggests that processes like policy really involve a collective interaction among many different actors with different agendas, values, cultures, different conceptions of power, knowledge, political influence, etc. And so again, that challenges our efforts as agencies like associations, and I think it influences the way in which the policy process is enacted. And this is really about a struggle for meeting and control of resources, because often with a policy effort, we're asking for some resource commitments to be made, and if we don't take into account the different vested interests that are really at play here, then I think we enter the exercise in a very naive way. So again, just, you know, I wouldn't be a good academic if I didn't have my critiques, but I think it does, taking in a unique actor-oriented perspective really overemphasizes the predispositions of individual and collective actors at the expense of those macro-level structures. So, you know, I think the take-home message here is really, you know, when we're trying to do policy development, it's an important interaction between macro and micro-level structures, and that is something that we need to take into account. So, you know, in a nutshell, I would say that the implications for those of us who develop, advocate, and or inform policy is complex and messy, it's non-linear and iterative, and that's been a critique of many policy models because they've been actually quite linear in their scope, and so for those who study policy, I think it's challenged them to rethink about the kinds of theories that are important to understand and learn, and I'll come back to that because that's about trying to make a difference. They operate in a very contested multi-stakeholder terrain. I've alluded to the power differentials that exist, and that I think this is also an important thing, that there are dominant discourses that eclipse other perspectives. And so often when you're, you know, the new kid on the block, as I like to call public health, it seems that we're always trying to get our message heard, that we're often competing with other very powerful discourses. So I think I don't need to remind folks who live in the U.S., and I think it's alive and well in our country, in Canada as well, is that this individual decision-making, the individual can decide, and we don't need societies to protect individuals from themselves. They have the freedom to choose, quote-unquote. And I think of a tendency for magic bullets, so technocratic solutions as opposed to collective solutions to health. So I think those kinds of discourses that are alive and well, whether it's in health or in many other sectors, challenge our efforts. So the next part of my talk is really just going to give you a very brief overview of the Canadian Public Health Association. We've been around for over 100 years. This is a bit about our history. We're the only Canadian non-governmental organization solely focused on public health. And we've really tried to pride ourselves as the only national voice and independent voice for public health. And so actually that's been a very interesting exercise insofar as in sustaining our financial stability, we've actually paid attention to the kind of dollars that are coming in and from which sources so that we don't really feel that we're being muzzled. Independence comes at a price, but it's really actually quite critical. So we're national in scope, international in reach. We have a voluntary membership, not too dissimilar from APHA. And, you know, we're primarily a policy, knowledge exchange, and advocacy organization. Those are the core functions. And the last point really speaks to the mission, which is what our members believe in, which is universal and equitable access to the basic conditions which are necessary to achieve health for all Canadians. So, again, I don't think too dissimilar from our other sister public health associations. So this one is compliments of Jim. And I think this is a great slide which indicates that some days policy development and advocacy feel like this, and often it's who we're blaming too. Some people would argue that that would probably set us off on a tailspin, and we don't always know which direction we're going in, and I think sometimes we have to be quite flexible in the direction we go. So, very briefly, our policy and advocacy track record, thanks to Jim's leadership, has not for 100 years. I'm always trying to thank our staff, but I self-corrected in the moment. Thank you very much. That's a good thing because I'm on tape. Yes, he's 150 years old. Yes, I know. Well, you see the air we breathe, you know, thanks to public health and the food we eat keeps Jim alive and well. No, anyway, enough said. So these are some of the areas we've had a track record on in terms of advocating for public health. We, like APHA, have gone through many priority-setting processes to identify what are the areas, and these are the ones that have traction, and quite interestingly, I think several of the top ones overlap with APHA's priorities, which I think presents a really great opportunity for partnership across our borders. I'm now going to move to the case of asbestos, and so what did we do? And this has been a long-term battle, but we'll sort of just recount briefly the last couple of years. And so we had a position on asbestos. We've had many other position papers on other topics, and they're all listed there, and I'm not going to go through them all because in the interest of time, I should probably get to asbestos. But this just gives you a sense of the gamut of issues that we address. So I'm just going to skip over that one. So here are some examples of the implications of mining. And I think for those of you who don't know, in particular in one of our provinces in Quebec, which, you know, of course tends to be the most socially progressive on public and social policies, in this case, they have a vested interest because mining has occurred there. So I think this is what links us economically to this public health issue. So the position, and I'll just give you a moment to read these out, really looked at ban mining, use and export, to cease the funding of an institute that actually existed to help promote this, the need to establish a surveillance system, because I think for those of you who know anything about this, it takes years for the effects, but we have enough data. And this is, I think, a great example of, and similar to the whole tobacco story, is that we've known for a fairly long time that this causes a very nasty set of cancers, yet that was evidence that was necessary but not sufficient to move the yardsticks forward. These are some of the other things that the policy were looking for: complete removal and replacement of asbestos-containing insulation in Indigenous community housing populations that are in particular much more vulnerable to this. So a real health equity lens here, I think, is coming through in our policy. Fair compensation to those who are already suffering, and public removal. And I used to actually work in the historic Banting building where insulin was, frequently I saw asbestos removal happening on a regular basis, but this is one of the oldest buildings at the University of Toronto, and so it really hit home the message that it was still alive and well and that its removal needed to continue. So that was the case of of asbestos. And sorry, it seems like some of my slides are missing. So anyway, I'll just go from memory here, but on September 14th, and this was shortly after the Quebec election, so no coincidence, federal government announced that it was going to close this institute and that it was actually doing an about-face reversal on this. And while public health had a major, I think, role to play in staying the course, we can't take full credit for it, but I think we are on record as having made a demonstration that public health was really was there and had been supported actually by many different organizations. And perhaps during the question period, Jim, and you may want to comment also on some of the other organizations that we were involved with. So just in the interest of time, because I only, I think, have 5 more minutes, right? So I wanted to talk a little bit about health equity, which is really a key focus of this conference, as well as many others. I think this is one of several examples of a wicked, intractable problem, something we need to continually put our attention towards, and I would argue this is a really good example of where we need to make some look for opportunities across public health associations for partnerships. So we have a really exciting initiative that's actually funded by a pharmaceutical company, and actually the federal government is not funding health equity, CPHA, to do any health equity, yet we have a grant from this organization, and really what this is helping us to do is a couple of things. It's actually helping us to build, similar to what APHA is doing on return on investment for making the case for public health, that we're doing some economic modeling and bringing some of the key stakeholders together, including economists, the right kind of economists, to build a case for investments in public health and in the social determinants of health, developing a position statement on a whole-of-government approach, and trying to create awareness and understanding among these different constituents. And I think the other part is really telling compelling, evidence-informed stories about how to create health equity, because Canada, you know, like many other countries, is the land of developing conceptual frameworks, of pilot projects, but I think one of our challenges has been to really get some traction on the ground and see some meaningful, effective action that will lead to the promotion of health equity. And so we feel this is really contributing to an understanding of how it can be done at multiple levels in the system, because we do need action, intersectoral action at the local, regional, provincial, in our case territorial, national, and international level. So in summary, I think we have sort of taken some takeaway messages from our work in policy and advocacy, the first being that we really need to stay the course, that you never know when that window of policy opportunity will open as it did for asbestos, but we were on record, and we were a credible organization who could then applaud the government for having made that decision. We didn't come out of the woodwork and all of a sudden say, oh, let's get in on this asbestos game. You know, we had had a long track record, and I think that's important. I've alluded to this. I think we really need to get real, and I know many people know this, but the evidence base is necessary, but it's not sufficient, and it's often behind. Actually, it's reactive. And so I think trying to get ahead of the curve and anticipate some of those questions, research really needs to do a better job at that to really inform policy. I've said this already about seizing windows of policy opportunity, and that requires us to be flexible and very nimble. And I think we are missing, although many of us have had discussions about this, exploring opportunities for cross-national collaboration across APHA, the World Federation, and CPHA, forming a bit of an alliance here where we can look at areas where we can work jointly. And then finally, I do think we really need to measure the policy influence we're having incrementally. Often we say we made a difference, but that was like 30 years out. I mean, we've got great narratives on the tobacco, lessons learned experience. But I would argue that, as a very key IOM report concluded for childhood obesity, that social change is really what we're on about. But we're not doing a very good job at measuring those incremental changes as we go. And so I think there are ways in which we can do that. We can start looking at how we're changing the discourse on issues, as simple as, although not easily done, framing issues not from an individual but a public health perspective, not a technocratic but a collective perspective, and looking at how that evidence and that framing from a public health perspective and health equity perspective shows up in documents, and really looking at the nature, quality, and extent of collaborations with relevant actors and how that's actually achieving some of the policy, as opposed to did we get the policy change we want, which is of course important, but very distal, and we really need to do a better job at measurement. So I always end with one of my favorite quotes from Gandhi: a policy is a temporary creed liable to be changed, but while it holds good, it has to be pursued with apostolic zeal, and I really think that that's what associations like ours are about. We really stay the core. We're tiny, mighty, but I think we really need the support of many people like yourselves in really advancing our position. So thanks for your interest. I was supposed to disclose.